Welcome back to hour two of the 9 till noon show this morning. Caller says, with regards to the A5, the main problem is speed. I never hear politicians talking about speed on this road. I drive this road 5 times a week. The most dangerous time of the morning is 5 a.m. and 8:30 as everyone speeds. Drivers are reckless. Sinn Féin did so well in Donegal because they haven't messed up County Donegal like they did with the rest of the country. The 100% Redress Party will run a candidate in the next general election and they will get a TD elected to the Dáil. So suggests one of our callers. Airbnbs. Caller says, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, there were B&Bs right throughout rural Ireland. Regulations have killed the industry. You'd have to spend thousands on your house to be compliant with regulations. Airbnb is going to go the same route. Now, it was self-catering accommodations. That's the specific focus of Moira that we were speaking to there before the break. And the point that she was making was that, yes, they do want to comply with regulations, but One of the questions is Airbnb is unregulated, it seems, at this moment. So, I mean, the whole issue of do you regulate and how do you regulate Airbnb is a major issue, and that's going to have to be addressed, one would think, by governments in years to come. Now, it seems, when you look at Donald Trump, that Donald fights with pretty much everybody, and now it's Donald Trump versus Taylor Swift. Now, I don't know. If you were seeking political office and you were hoping to get a lot of young people voting for you, would you start going after Taylor Swift? I certainly wouldn't, particularly given that Taylor Swift is one of the most articulate, independent and intelligent people in the music industry. But apparently, Taylor Swift is a fake liberal, and the embattled former president, and as he hopes himself, future president, has suggested in a book that the singer's political views are just an act. In his book, Apprentice in Wonderland, Trump says of Taylor Swift, she's legitimately liberal. It's not an act. It surprises me that a country star can be successful being liberal. Yeah, I'm not sure, Donald. I'd be scaling back now, and I wouldn't be going too hard on Taylor, because if it comes to a Taylor Swift versus Donald Trump battle in the minds of young people, I suspect there's only going to be one winner. Now, I won't tell you who I think it's going to be, but I'll just give you one hint. My daughter thinks she's a very good singer. Going to be talking golf in just a few moments, a very interesting and important event coming up over the next few days. It's happening up in Inishowen, as so much does in golf in Donegal. We'll be getting to that very shortly. First of all, though, I was intrigued by a story I read this morning in the Irish Daily Mail, written by Colin Fernandez, and it came via, I'm sure, their sister paper in the UK. It seems a manned mission to Mars will fail, as astronauts will suffer kidney failure on the trip. Now, there's been a lot of talk about missions to Mars and getting people to Mars, and as we all know from the book and film starring Matt Damon, getting to Mars is one thing, getting back from Mars is something completely different altogether. But now it seems that astronauts could have a serious issue with their kidneys when they go to space, because a comprehensive review of the health impacts of space travel on the 24 astronauts who went to space has shown that many suffered changes to their kidneys. Most astronauts only spend between 6 and 12 days in space, but 8 years exposed to galactic radiation, the time it would take for a return trip to Mars, would result in painful kidney stones and might require dialysis. That's according to a study by University College London, according to scientists. The US space agency NASA and the electric car tycoon Elon Musk have both set manned missions to Mars as goals. However, they say unless new drugs to protect kidneys are developed, the health risk would jeopardize any future 106 million kilometer round trip, according to experts. Now, let's get that into perspective in our heads, because getting to the moon, and they're talking about going back to the moon again in the next 2 years or so with men and women traveling. Getting to the moon takes 3 days there, maybe 2 days on, 3 days back, if that. Getting to Mars is going to be an 8-year round trip. So, number one, you're trying to get a crew together who are prepared to spend 4 years travelling. Now, we know from science fiction, and science fiction is wonderful, I love it. In science fiction, what happens is everyone gets put into special cryogenic booths. They're put into a deep sleep. They sleep for 3.5 years, and then they're woken up as they're about to arrive. One suspects in real life that's not going to happen because they're films. And it would certainly be a pressure on the health. And we're told that by NASA that the situation is that if we have people in space, space flights will cause several issues, including loss of bone mass, weakness of the heart and eyesight, and that problem with kidney stones. Many of the issues are believed to stem from this exposure to space radiation. And if it's serious after 3 days, what's it going to be like after more than 3 years? It ain't going to happen anytime soon, folks. Okay, I promised you a discussion on golf and interesting things happening in North Inishowen. And of course, when you speak about golf and North Inishowen, let's be honest, you're speaking about Ballyliffin. And John Farron is manager of Ballyliffin Golf Club. Delighted to say John joins us on Zoom. John, good morning.
Morning, Donald. How are you?
Very well indeed. Thanks, John. Ballyliffin, a prestigious history of staging major tournaments. I say major with a small M, not a capital M. That's another story altogether. But in terms of what Ballyliffin has been hosting over the years, another big, big event taking place this coming weekend.
Yeah, probably the most prestigious event that can be staged on this side of the Atlantic, the Amateur Championship, an R&A run event. Some of the best amateurs in the world will be here starting tomorrow with practice for the pre-qualifying and culminating next Saturday with the final over 36 holes. So really looking forward to it, Donald, and hopefully the summer will arrive at some stage within the next couple of days.
And the reality is that we may this weekend in Ballyliffin see the Sergio Garcias, the Tiger Woods, the Colin Montgomerys of the future.
Absolutely. This is the creme de la creme of amateur golf throughout the world. Most of these guys are college players in America about to turn pro. So they're at the top of their game, and really, they are the next tranche of Rory McIlroy's, etc. And some spectacular golf. In fact, the golf is probably of a standard that would be, you know, equivalent to a European or a DP World Tour event, such as their skills and talent.
And as you said, the word is amateur, but people will well remember when Shane Lowry was an amateur and he set the world alight. Tiger Woods, when he was in his final year as an amateur, he was setting the world alight. So I mean, I'm sure there's going to be people taking part in that championship in Ballyliffin who are, you know, are going to set the world alight again. And sometimes maybe in our own heads, when we think of amateur golf, we think of a bunch of lads going off for a weekend and playing a few rounds. This most certainly is not that.
No, these guys are more or less professional, really, Donald. They're full-time golfers, albeit that they may be at college in the States. They're generally speaking on college sponsorship, and really it's a route to the top of the tree in terms of the PGA Tour or the European DP World Tour. So, you know, yeah, this is professional golf, for want of a better word, on scale.
What does it take to secure an event like this? Because it isn't that the organisers wake up someday and say, hang on, I saw a nice article in a magazine about some golf course in Donegal. Why don't we take a look at that? If only it were that simple, but I'm sure it's far from it.
No, it has been years in the making. It probably started with our staging of the
Irish
the
Open.
Boys, Home Internationals, way back in 2016, I think it was. And 2022, we staged the men's and women's home internationals here. Obviously, continuing to develop our relationship with the R&A and trying to secure bigger and better events each year. So we were delighted when they came to the table offering us the amateur championship. And, you know, we're delighted to have them here. They are the governing body of golf worldwide, and they run the Open Championship, mm-hmm. which, you know, obviously is an aspiration that we would have, albeit that it will take considerable amount of work to get that over the line. But listen, if we can't dream, we will never get there.
Well, I mean, you've got this coming up. You ran a very successful Irish Open some years ago that people still talk about, and you still see the signs welcoming you into Donegal when you cross the border from Northern Ireland. And let's talk about that cross-border aspect for a moment, because, I mean, you spoke about the Open. Now, the Open is one of the majors. Now, I mean, I jokingly made a major reference earlier, but I mean, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that Ballyliffin Golf Club in the not too distant future could be hosting a major.
Yeah, why not? That's why they've changed it from, it was formerly called the British Open, but they've changed it now to just call it the Open. So it is open for the RNA to move it outside Britain. And obviously Portmarnock have put their hat in the ring. We too are very interested in having a discussion with the RNA, albeit that no formal discussions have taken place as yet. But we are building our reputation with them, and this week and next will be, you know, very important in terms of showcasing Ballyliffin and the region as to what we could do and potential of staging further bigger and better events, albeit that there's very few bigger than the Amateur Championship. But, you know, the likes of the Walker Cup and ultimately the Open would be, you know, things that we aspire to. And if you'd said to anyone in Donegal, you know, 10 years ago that the Irish Open was going to come to Ballyliffin, they probably would have laughed at you. And that's true throughout the country. So, you know, if we can't dream, we'll never get there. And certainly that's something that we will be trying to address with the RNA this week when they're visiting.
But you have proven time and again that Ballyliffin has risen to numerous challenges. And, I mean, in a bid for the Open, especially if it were a straight fight between yourselves and Portmarnock, now, obviously it isn't, and it's nowhere near that simple, but you do have that cross-border element. You do have the facility of being able to say, well, look, not only do we have all the accommodation and all the facilities around Inishowen, just look at our neighbours in Derry across the border. We can link in there. So, you know, you still have that cross-border element. And that's something that the RNA might look, you know, well on, particularly as if I'm correct. I mean, there have been some very successful stagings in places like Portrush, you know, and they will know the Portrush area. They will know the northwest of Ireland well themselves already.
Oh, absolutely. Portrush is probably the most successful Open Championship of the modern era. And that was a big step for the RNA to take, to take it back there after 50 odd years. So certainly they've seen the benefits of bringing major golf to this part of the world, where, you know, people are very enthusiastic about the game and it brings out the crowds. In terms of infrastructure, we're lucky in that we have parking facilities on site, or have access to parking facilities on site. So it's a very, it's very simple infrastructurally to organize an event of, you know, massive scale, which the Open is probably four times the size of an Irish Open. So yeah, we'd have to tweak our arrangements for the Irish Open, but certainly I think it's achievable, and you know, hopefully some stage we will get into serious discussions about that.
Going back to the Amateur Championships taking place this weekend, I mean, I'm sure this means an awful lot to your entire membership and to the people of Ballyliffin, Clonmany and further afield, because you're going to need a huge amount of stewards, you're going to need a huge amount of caddies, you're going to need a huge amount of people working around the course and outside the course. And this is something, it's not going to happen in isolation. I'm sure this is something that's going to pull in the whole local community, and that community buy-in is going to be a vital part of what happens.
Oh, absolutely. Economically, we're estimating it'll be somewhere between 3.5 and 5 million injection into the local economy, staging the event, which, you know, is important for a rural tourism economy. Yeah, volunteering is a big part of it. We've over 140 volunteers on site for the whole week. It's free in, free entry, and free parking on site here. So we're hoping if the weather is kind, we'll get the Northwest community out in force to support the event and witness some of the greatest golfers in the world, you know, playing around the Donegal links of Ballyliffin. So yeah, it's a big one for the local community, and people are really looking forward to it, and the members are really cherishing showcasing once again the two courses here in Ballyliffin on the world stage. It will be going out live on Sky for the last 2 days. During the course of the week, the RNA will be putting out on their YouTube channel, which, you know, is important in terms of profiling the region and getting more tourism visitors coming to Ballyliffin, Donegal and the Northwest region in general.
And I'm sure your marketing people have been looking at the analysis since the Irish Open staging and other major events in terms of the impact it's having on bringing golf tourism to Ballyliffin. And I suppose if someone is going to come to play golf in Ballyliffin because they have seen it on Sky or ESPN or wherever they've seen it in the world that they watch, or YouTube, they may decide to come and play golf in Ballyliffin. But the great thing is, once they're in Ballyliffin, look, we may as well go to, what's that Rossapenna place like? How about this? What's that Murlock, you call it, or Letterkenny, or what's it, Port Salon? That looks nice. I mean, I'm sure if people come over to play Ballyliffin, that's going to have a throw on effect for the other courses around Donegal, and the whole of the county is going to benefit from what you're doing.
Oh, absolutely. Like, people don't come to Ireland to play one golf course or two golf courses. It's a part of, generally, it's a week-long or 10-day break. So, you know, Donegal is blessed with some of the best links courses in the world. And you've mentioned them there, Morva, Portsallan, Rosapenna. But there are others, Northwest and Dunfanaghy. We have a great breadth of quality there. And that's something that, you know, we're keen to retain tourism spend within the Donegal economy, so that, you know, we're spreading that tourism impact throughout the county. And that is very true. Like, people come and they sort of frog hop around the county, and that's what it's all about, making sure that they stay within the Donegal region and continue to spend their money in the various facilities, not just golf, but the other tourism attractions, the pubs, the restaurants, the hotels. And so that everybody gets a spin out, that helps the local economy and employment, obviously, and that keeps us all going here.
As you say, the preparatory work gets underway this week. We have qualifying getting underway this coming Friday, and then on the 17th and 18th there's stroke play, there's match day Wednesday to Friday, and then the final taking place on Saturday next June 22nd. So, you know, a very interesting 9-10 days ahead from your point of view and your team. The cream of amateur golf globally is going to be in Ballyliffin over the course of the next couple of days. And the word to be, and I have to say, I'm stunned you're telling us that it's a free in and it's free parking. But I know people went to a big garden festival in Dublin at the weekend and they were charged 10 or 15 quid to park. So you're effectively saying, you know, come and see the best amateur golfers in the world and do it for free.
Yeah, and there are facilities on site. There's outside catering, bar, etc. And, you know, plenty of room to roam, with two golf courses in action for Saturday, Sunday, Monday and Tuesday, 288 players out. You know, there's plenty of golf to witness. That then is filtered down to 64 players into the match play stages on Glashidi links from Wednesday on. And it culminates with the 36-hole final on next Saturday, which will be, you know, a feast for the senses.
Mm. John Farron, manager of Ballyliffin Golf Club, we wish you all the best. As you say, we will pray to the weather gods that they will look kindly on Ballyliffin and its environs for the coming days. May this be the success that Ballyliffin is well capable of delivering. We wish you and the team well, John, and may the golf be only mighty.
Thanks a million, Donald.
John Farron, thank you. That's John, the manager there of Ballyliffin Golf Club. And what did they say? If you don't aim big, you don't get what you want. And fair play to Ballyliffin Golf Club and to John and his team. They aim big. And hey, the rewards are coming thick and fast. Who knows? The Open Championship, hey, it mightn't be too far away. It's the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. If you want to give us your views on the issues of the day or lay out a subject you'd like to hear discussed on the show, you can text us or WhatsApp us on 086 60 25000. You can call us on 07491 25000, 00353 7491 25000 if you're outside of the dialing area, or you can make contact electronically, comments at Highland Radio on email, at Highland Radio on X, Highland Hub on Facebook. We're also on other social media channels, and you can watch us on Facebook on both the Highland Radio and Highland Radio News and Sport pages. And you can watch us on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, and the programme going out live there. And a very good morning to Sarah, one of the people who is watching us on our live stream this morning. Now, let's talk about the Ombudsman's report, which has been published today. Hospitals, social welfare and education schemes contribute to a rise of complaints to the Ombudsman, and a number of those complaints have come from Donegal. Ombudsman Ger Deering's annual report highlights a continuing rise in complaints. There were 3,418 in 2020. In 2023, that has risen to 4,465. And the Ombudsman, Ger Deering, joins us on the line. Ger, a very good morning to you. I'm sure it's a very busy day for you when this report is released, because you're going to have journalists like myself ringing you all day, radio programmes, TV programmes, others looking for the local skinny, looking for the local quotes. As you look at the figures, are you surprised that you've seen that level of increase since 2020?
I'm not really surprised, Donald, and you're correct in saying that this is a busy day, but we've engaged quite a bit recently with people like yourselves. This is not the first time I've been on Highland Radio, and I think, you know, by working with people like yourself and also community groups and interest groups across the country. We're trying to create a greater awareness of the office. So I think there's two things happening, really. One is, I hope and believe there's a better awareness that what we do and how we can make a complaint. But of course, there's a huge increase in the public services that are being provided and the people who are accessing public services. And if you think of the literally millions of transactions a year that happen right across the public sector, it's not surprising in a way that there would be more complaints. But I suppose the key message we want to get across is the importance of complaining when things do go wrong, if people are unhappy. Because you can see from today's report that it doesn't just benefit the person who makes the complaint. It can have a significant benefit for other people in terms of increasing the quality of public services generally.
And presumably as well, it makes, if there is an issue with a public service, if a complaint is made, if that complaint is addressed and the protocols are put in place within that public service, as you said, that it benefits other users of that service, and presumably it actually benefits that service and its employees and its team as well, because it's going to make life easier for them, because they're going to be able to offer a better service to their service users going into the future. One of the points that's been raised, particularly in Donegal, it seems, looking very briefly at the report, is cross-border treatment schemes. Now, coincidentally, we had a discussion on this on the programme yesterday in a different context, and I just want to make sure that people know that this is not linked to the discussion we had yesterday. That was a slightly separate issue, so I'm just going to park what we were talking about yesterday. And I want to talk to you about these cross-border treatment schemes, because whatever about someone in Galway or Killarney or Ringaskiddy or Dungarvan being able to access treatment in Northern Ireland, from Letterkenny, it's a 40-minute drive to Kingsbridge in Ballykelly, and it's a facility used a lot in Donegal. But it's not been a facility that's been without its problems.
Well, the schemes themselves did run into some difficulty, and we were receiving complaints about cross-border schemes. And as you say, they're particularly relevant to those of you who live closer to the border. But it was an issue for people right throughout the country, and indeed not just accessing services in Northern Ireland, but in other jurisdictions as well. So what we found was that the schemes were really being overly bureaucratically administered. So, for example, somebody in Donegal might access cataract surgery in somewhere in Northern Ireland. And they may have a very good neighbour, friend, son, daughter, whoever, who kindly would have brought them to that surgery. And at one stage, the HSE was looking for proof of travel. Now, if you have a good neighbour who kindly brings you there, they're not going to ask you for the money, usually, for the diesel or the petrol, or produce a receipt to you for the diesel or the petrol. So these kind of practicalities. But there were even more difficult issues arising. For example, if a referral letter wasn't properly signed, or if, depending on where the source of the money came from, people were finding that they went, had the surgery done in good faith, resolved their health issue, but then unfortunately ended up in debt for one reason or another to, you know, maybe a family member or a credit union. Because by their nature, these schemes help people who don't have private health insurance. If you had private health insurance, there's a very good chance you might access the treatment in the South or in the Republic without the need to travel. So we did an investigation into these schemes, and we found these over-bureaucratic practices. But I'm very happy to say it's a really good example of what you were talking about earlier, how the system can improve for everybody, for the staff of the HSE, for the, most importantly, for the patients accessing it, but absolutely for everybody, because there's a win-win here. If more people, they're very good schemes in themselves, by the way, and the vast majority of people didn't have a difficulty. So if more people are accessing these, they're coming off long waiting lists in the Republic, and that system is benefiting as well. So I made 21 recommendations to Bernard Gloucester, the CEO of the HSE, and I'm very happy to say that the HSE is implementing those very much in the spirit that we would have wanted. And now, not alone have quite a number of people who were refused refunds got those refunds back. And I hear it, you know, you hear the actual stories of the person who borrowed 11,000 from her sister to have her hip replaced. You can imagine how she felt when she wasn't able to get that money afterwards. But those people have been reimbursed now. But equally importantly, or very importantly, the schemes now are administered in a much better way.
Yeah.
And people find that they're able to access them and don't have the difficulties they were running into before.
In terms of those schemes, one of the things that may have caused confusion, particularly at the start of them, is that there previously was the National Treatment Purchase Fund, whereby people on the hospital waiting list would be referred either to somewhere like Ballykelly or indeed either to the Galway Clinic or the Mater or wherever to have the surgery done. And that was a referral within the HSE. They went there, they got the treatment, no money changed hands, they weren't out of pocket. and people may have engaged with the cross-border treatment scheme. I can't remember its precise name right now. I think it was the European cross-border treatment scheme or whatever it was called. But under that one, as you've said, people paid, got the treatment, paid up front and then claimed the money back from the HSC. What was the confusion in the early stages of that second scheme where people thought it was like the NTPF where they didn't lay out any money and then suddenly found themselves facing bills they didn't anticipate?
That may have been an issue, but in fact there are three, apart from the National Treatment Purchase, which, as you rightly say, Donald, is completely separate to this, there were actually three schemes. There were two cross-border schemes, and then there was a very specific UK-Irish scheme put in place when Brexit happened. But effectively, it operated like the EU cross-border scheme. And in some of those schemes, in one of those schemes, what would happen is you would get approval in advance, and in fact everything would be paid, the treatment would be paid. So you would access it a bit like the treatment purchase fund as you described it. But then there were the other schemes where you actually could, you didn't need advance sanction. You went and had the treatment done, but there were very specific criteria. For example, you had to have a referral, as you could imagine. And we accept most of the criteria that was in the scheme. Yeah. You had to have a referral letter from a GP or a consultant, depending on the scheme it was. But one of the difficulties was, you know, doctors are busy people and sometimes somebody else would actually sign the referral letter. So the doctor's secretary maybe would sign it on his or her behalf. The HSC didn't accept that, even in circumstances where the person went back and got a letter from the doctor to confirm this was actually the referral. So in another case, we had a woman who, she obviously wasn't in a position to pay, but her sister travelled with her and her sister paid for the treatment, but the scheme said you must pay for the treatment, and you know, bureaucracy decided, well, you is not your sister, and you know, those are the kind of problems. So really, the vast majority of problems were not problems of the making of the patient. The patient had the work, had the surgery done, or had the treatment done in good faith and expected to receive payment when they came back, but didn't. But I do want to stress and remind people that they're very good schemes and they are operating very well now.
And the issues tend to be unwieldy bureaucracy rather than any kind of malpractice or malice, that sometimes the biggest issue is that it's just a big, huge, unwieldy bureaucratic system. It isn't that someone is doing wrong or that there is malpractice in here, and that's the problem. The biggest issue here isn't people. The biggest here sometimes is just the system.
Yeah. That's an important point. I mean, technically the scheme was being correctly run, you know, as in the doctor should have signed the letter, the person should have paid for the treatment. But, you know, you can't operate. The world doesn't operate like that. You need a little bit of empathy and a little bit of discretion and flexibility in these kind of schemes.
A caller is asking, I'm not happy with a special needs service that a child was in. Can I contact you to make a complaint?
Yes, they can contact us. And we'd encourage anybody, wherever there's a doubt. I mean, the service must be a publicly funded service. But it's always best that people would contact us and check. And if for any reason we can't deal with it. Now, that person, I think, has mentioned that it's a child. So there is the Children's Ombudsman. However, if it was the case, we would talk to the person. If we believed it was for the Children's Ombudsman or some other organisation, we would refer it on. But I would urge them to contact us for sure and give us the details and we can check it out for them.
Obviously, housing is a huge point of discussion right across the board, locally and nationally. And perhaps not surprisingly, housing-related complaints have made up the majority of complaints when it comes to complaints about local councils.
Yes, that's true. Now, again, we won't be able to produce houses for people, and I'm sure people understand that when they come to us, but in all complaints that we deal with, Donald, we take a human rights-based approach. And by that, we mean we look at how are people treated? Were they treated with respect and dignity in their dealings with the local authority? And you'll actually, there's a case study in our annual report this year to do with housing. And it was very much that point that obviously the housing or lack of housing was a key issue. But actually what was equally as important was that the people were not treated with respect and dignity by the local authority in the communications that they had. So, you know, again, we look at things like HAP. We're actually undertaking an investigation into HAP because we have received a number of complaints about its operation. So we look at the operation of these things, the schemes and the housing applicants. One that comes to mind in terms of housing, I remember a family where all housing applicants are written to every so often to confirm that there's still housing need so that the local authority can update its lists. But I know in Galway County Council on one occasion they wrote to all of the people concerned. They didn't receive a response from one particular family it was a traveller family who, you know, there may have been issues in terms of mobility or indeed communication itself. But because they didn't receive the response by the due date, they took the family off the housing list. We engaged, they put the family back on the housing list, but they put them back from today's date. Now, the family had actually been 12 years on the housing list. Yeah. So to lose that 12 years would have been, you know, just a punishment, a penal for inadvertently not replying to a letter. So we got them reinstated on the housing list from 12 years. So those are the kind of issues we can deal with in terms of housing.
And again, what was probably happening in this instance too, particularly when they were added back on the list, is the person who added them back filled in the form absolutely correctly. And sometimes the filling in of the form correctly is more important in people's eyes than perhaps actually looking humanly at the situation. An interesting question has come into us here, and I'm going to put this to you. You'll be aware, I'm sure, that there is a major defective blocks crisis in Donegal. Now, it's in the private sector in as much as it's houses that were built by building contractors using blocks that were sourced from private suppliers, and there were considerable issues with the blocks, which are now having a huge effect on houses and families locally. However, a caller says, I know that a lot of the defective block crisis in Donegal is based on the private sector, but the failure is at its root a failure of government to apply building regulations and to allow a situation develop where defects in blocks came through because the regulations that should have determined them were not followed through by government and there weren't proper inspections. Is there any competence for your office to look at that in terms of that a government failure on one level led to problems which are on the face of it in the private sector?
We can look at systemic issues, and we do from time to time carry out what we call own initiative investigations. However, I wouldn't see us getting involved in the, as you rightly point out, the private side of that. There were private transactions between individuals and builders. However, I know we're all aware that there is a redress scheme in place. And while we wouldn't second guess the redress that somebody would be offered, we would possibly be able to look at how they were treated, if there were any difficulties in you know, accessing the scheme or in how they were dealt with as part of that. But in terms of the actual, if you want to call it the original fault, it isn't something that our office could become involved in.
And would you have any competence in assessing the appropriateness of the scheme or whether the scheme should be different, or do you have to take the scheme as it legally stands and work just within the parameter of that?
We would take the scheme as it legally stands. Our role would really be, I suppose the treatment abroad scheme is a very good example. We didn't change any of the criteria that existed in the scheme, but what we were able to look at was how is that actually being interpreted and administered. So it's that area that we can bring our expertise and our investigation to.
Let's look at one of the, I suspect, major success stories for your office. You say there is a significant fall off in complaints about the passport service. Now, we know years back the passport service would have been notorious. It seems to have got a lot better, and I've no doubt part of that is down to the fact that you would have investigated quite a number of complaints over the years.
Yes, well, particularly in 2022, and in fact it featured in our annual report, I think we had about 800 complaints against the passport office. There was accumulation of things that happened there. We had Brexit, we had COVID, we had a whole range of things. But one thing that comes to mind, for example, at that stage when we were looking at it, we found that the complaint system which the passport office had at that particular time was a written one. So, you know, if you were living in wherever abroad, you had to write to the passport office if you had a difficulty. They had an online application system, but yet their complaint system was a postal-based system. And indeed, there are many countries that people might live in who would need to interact with the passport office that would hardly have a postal system or a very poor postal system. So one of the things that they've done at our request and recommendation has been to bring that complaint system online. And a complaint system is a really important tool for any organisation. Any organisation that tries to limit complaints or that ignores complaints really is missing out on a very valuable tool for assessing its own service. I think public bodies and everybody should actually consider complaints to be very important feedback and learn from those complaints. Not all complaints will be upheld. Some people might have unreasonable expectations, but you know, very many of the complaints point up issues that sometimes are systemic or sometimes are just about an individual who could do better in their job, or the organisation has been doing something the same way for 20 years and nobody has actually queried, well, really, do we need to do that and do we need all of that?
Ombudsman Ger Deering, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Just one final question, Ger. Can people access this report online? I presume at this point it's available for anyone to peruse?
Absolutely. It's up on our website and I would encourage people, ombudsman.ie, I'd encourage people to go there and have a look and see, particularly the case studies, give people a really good example or an understanding of, I hope, what we do.
Ger Deering, thank you very much indeed. That's Ger Deering there, the Ombudsman. Now, we're going to change tack completely. As you will know, Leaving Cert students are sitting their exams this week. They began last week. But there is a suggestion that perhaps the Leaving Cert should be abolished in favour of an open access policy for our universities. That's being pushed by People Before Profit. Delighted to say we're joined online by Deputy Paul Murphy of People Before Profit. Paul, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Thanks for having me on.
Paul, it's an interesting concept. I sat through the Leaving Cert 40-plus years ago. You sat through the Leaving Cert a damn sight more recently, I fear. Thousands of people listening to this show have sat through the Leaving Cert. And it's not perfect, but it's a springboard and it's a way of preparing people for college. That's the theory. You believe there is an alternative.
I do, yeah. I mean, I think there's two reasons we should scrap the Leaving Cert. One is the enormous stress that it places on people. Three quarters of young people say they feel extreme stress as a result of doing it. And again, most of your listeners will know that feeling of how much stress, how much pressure is placed on these couple of weeks of exams. My heart goes out to any young people who are doing it at the moment. It contributes to mental health crisis that exists in our society. And the second reason is that I think it crystallizes the inequality that exists in our society and in our education system. And there's a huge class bias baked into the nature of the Leaving Cert, where, for example, if you live in an affluent area, you are 10 times more likely to get higher points out of the Leaving Cert than if you live in a deprived area. And it isn't because people who live in affluent areas are any smarter than people who live in deprived areas. It's because of a whole range of factors, including access to grind schools, access to grinds, access to like space to study, having parents maybe who went to university. And so it crystallizes this disadvantage, this inequality, to the disadvantage of working class young people. And I think to the disadvantage of our society, because there's loads of people out there who would make excellent doctors or lawyers or lecturers or nurses or scientists or whatever, who don't get that chance to contribute in that way to our society because of the kind of inequality that is then reflected in people's Leaving Cert results.
How then do you regulate how people take places for limited courses in university? I mean, we do know that one of the reasons for the point system, and the point system is an extremely blunt instrument, but we do know that the number of medical places, the number of dental places, the number of actuary places, veterinary places and so on are extremely limited. If you don't have a point system based on the Leaving Cert to limit the how you get people in there, what do you use in its place as an admission criteria?
Yeah, I think that's the essential question, because the point system comes from a place of scarcity. We have scarce places in third level education and more people chasing those places. So just what that difference is, right, is about 25,000 places a year. So about 80,000 people apply for third level places a year through the CAO, and about 55,000 of them get a place in third level. So it's not massive, but it's there. But the way you do it is, one, investment in more places in third level education. So 50 years ago, there used to be a thing called the primary certificate, which people would do at the end of primary school, and which they'd have to do well in order to get into secondary school. So the assumption was that for working class young people then, is your education is finishing at the end of primary school. That's no longer the case, and we take it for granted that everyone goes on to second level education, and the vast majority of people now go all the way through second level education. And so similarly, we can say that there will be a place, we invest in it, it costs €500 million, it's the same amount of money that the state is planning to increase spending on military hardware over the coming years, that we invest to say that there will be a place in college for everybody who wants it. And then what that looks like, it's similar to the system in France or in Italy, where everyone who finishes secondary school can go on to third level education, And it probably means starting with, for most people, kind of an omnibus, what they call an omnibus entry. So, for example, you want to finish up doing medicine, you'd start doing a year of science. And at the end of doing science, you would do exams which actually relate to science, as opposed to the exams that you do in your leaving materials, many of which don't really relate to whether you'll be a good doctor or not. And on that basis, then the more limited places in medicine or whatever would be allocated out.
The question then becomes, if you have a situation where you've abolished the leaving cert, you've based, if there is to be a measure of success through the second level system, you base it on in-class assessments, you base it on essays, you base it on projects, you base it on whatever. It's still going to get to a point where at some stage in college, someone is going to have to sit down and do an exam. And if they haven't had the preparation of the junior cert and the leaving cert, blunt though that may be, scary though that may be, will the exam they now face in the first year in college be an even more daunting prospect?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think for most of us, like the most daunting, most stressful exam that we ever did was the leaving cert. It isn't matched by what you go on to do in college.
I have to agree there. I do have to agree there, yes.
So you know, I'm not saying that you wouldn't have exams, you wouldn't have homework, you wouldn't have, you know, tests and so on through school, as you do currently in years other than sixth year. So you would continue to have those, people would continue to do it, but you would avoid this massive stress and this massive pressure of cramming, you know? I mean, I tell you, I'm pretty good at memorizing things for, like, a number of days. So the leaving cert suited me. I could memorize all the stuff in a couple of days before the exam and remember it all. It doesn't mean I knew it 2 weeks later than that. It didn't really mean that I was going to be good at whatever on in life. You know, it isn't really a very good test of whether you'll be a good whatever. And I think exams in college, as well as the kind of continuous assessment that goes on in college, are a better test of that. I also think it's important to say, by the way, I'm not saying that third level education is for everybody. There's lots of other ways that people contribute to society. I think we need to massively expand apprenticeships, for example. But I am saying that we shouldn't restrict access and say, no, you haven't done good enough in your leaving cert. Because effectively, you know, this isn't a meritocracy. It's like a 100-meter race where some people are starting 50 meters down or 75 meters down. We aren't all starting from equal places because of the inequality that exists in our society. And there isn't a need to do that. Like, it is a choice to have artificial scarcity of third-level education places, and we can do away with that.
Can I ask you a blunt question? Is it your belief that we have lost potentially brilliant surgeons, we've lost potentially brilliant vets, because they were born in Ballymun rather than Dockey?
Definitely. There's a quote, I can't remember exactly who said it. Someone said, they were asked about like Einstein's brain and how great Einstein's brain was. And they said, you know, I'm less concerned about the precise measurements of Einstein's brain than I am about the fact that there are, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, whatever, of potential Einsteins out there that we never got the benefit from. And I do think, like, this is about those individuals who are prevented from reaching their full capacity, but also about society losing out. You know, and I think when you go back to it, again, like, can you justify a situation where if you're from an affluent area or you go to a school in an affluent area, you're 10 times more likely to get high points in the leaving cert? And, you know, I'm sure everyone agrees that those people in affluent areas are no smarter or less smart than people in deprived areas. And it does indicate that, like, we as a society are hugely missing out on a whole bunch of talents that we should instead allow to flourish. And I think in the end we'll benefit our society. It will not be a cost to our society, but would ultimately be a benefit.
Deputy Paul Murphy, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning.